Good evening. You are listening to the Year Now podcast. Today is the 16th of April, 2024. And joining me this evening, we have the inimitable Bronwyn.
Kiora.
And the run of the mill, Mark.
Oh, thanks. That is so kind of you.
Yes. Well, I couldn't boost your ego anymore.
You're saying my ego's already high?
Well, no, probably not.
And not after we're going to so cruelly take you down a few notches for your new car.
How are you going to do that?
I don't know. Why don't you tell the audience first and we'll think of some gags.
We bought a second car this past weekend.
The reason for that is that Susan, my wife, has been laughing at me about it. I didn't even last 2 weeks at work before I decided that I didn't like the bus and wanted to drive to work instead of taking the bus. But yeah, I had some good reasons. I mean, the bus to get to work, it was taking me 3/4 of an hour in the morning and up to an hour and a half to get home at night. And so, I mean, that was a big chunk of my day commuting. And in addition, because it required two buses, it was costing me nearly $15 a day on the bus, which is pretty expensive, really, for public transport. I mean, it'd be really good if public transport was cheaper. So anyway, I thought, we'd look around for another EV, and my idea was to buy a really, really cheap one, like an old Nissan Leaf. And Susan's idea was no, if we were going to get a second car, then it would be something reasonably decent rather than something crappy. And of course, and the whole reasoning in this was that since we were a one car family, she said, well, now that you've decided to drive to work, you are not driving the car every day and leaving me here without a car. So
instead of spending $7,000 on a third hand Leaf, what did you buy and how much did it cost, if you dare say that publicly?
So the car that Susan said that she had liked, which we had previously sort of driven when our car was being fixed, was a BMW i3. So I don't know whether it's just good luck, but she was doing her scrapbooking on Saturday, and I was going to do some work, and she said, I bet you spend all day looking for a car. So I looked on Trade Me, and there happened to be this BMW i3 that a guy had put on the night before. So I rang him up, and we arranged to go around and have a look at it that afternoon, as we had a drive of it, and we were quite pleased with it. So long story short, we paid 25K for this 8-year-old i3, but it is in immaculate condition, and it was an ex-BMW Auckland demonstrator. And so it has actually got every single possible extra on it that you can get.
So the one mod con that it's missing that you mentioned on Facebook is the personalized number plate, just so people know how poncy you are.
We'll get there.
All right.
But I play quite pleased with it. It's got leather seats, it's got a nice sunroof called a moonroof, apparently. Although the range of it is actually quite small, it's got a relatively small battery. It's designed as sort of a city commuting car, so it has 120 k's of range on its battery. It has a thing called a range extender, which is a little petrol engine that can charge the battery to give you an extra 100 k's of range. So if you're driving around and you actually run out of EV battery juice, then this little petrol engine kicks in and starts charging the battery to extend your range. And the car only takes about 9 litres of fuel. So it's a pretty tiny tank, so you can't go very far on it, but it does at least get you out of a bind if you happen to run out of battery power. But the really good thing about this is that because it has a petrol engine, It's classed as a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle.
And road user charges
are only $38 per thousand kilometers versus $76 per thousand kilometers for a full EV. So nice. I like this. So my 40K round trip into town and back is costing me probably about 50 cents of electricity and $1.40 or something of road user charges.
Plus wear and tear on the vehicle, etc.
Well, yes, there is all that. There is all that. And better still, I can park about 15 minutes away from work, 15 minutes walking away from work for free.
Cool.
It means I get a nice 15-minute walk in the morning and 10-minute walk at night. It takes longer to get to work because it's uphill and then shorter to get back to the car because it's downhill. But, yes, that means I get a bit of exercise each day.
And, the engine, you said basically 9 litres would get you 100Ks. That doesn't sound right. Like, I have a hybrid, and I can get on a 40-litre tank probably about 900 kilometres or more out of it. So that means I'm kind of like 200 kilometres or a bit more than that on 10 litres.
Yes, you are. Maybe it's a bit more than that.
I wonder whether they've just underquoted so you don't rely on it too much and then, you know, have a complaint when you run out.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I don't really want to be running a petrol engine because I don't actually want to be putting I don't really want to be running on fossil fuels. But the way the car is designed, it is designed so that even if you always drive on battery, it kicks in a maintenance cycle so that it runs the petrol engine for a little bit of time just to make sure that all the oils move around, the parts keep moving and things don't seize up.
Makes sense.
So, we'll probably sort of drive it like that occasionally just to keep things ticking over.
And any idea how many cc the engine is? Because like in mine, it's a 1.2 litre. So it's a small engine, but because it's electric drive, you know, my car still moves nicely. I'm guessing it's going to be tiny. Is it like a lawnmower engine? What does it sound like?
Something like that, I think. I mean, it's designed to just charge the battery. So it's a generator rather than something that actually moves the car along.
Yeah, that's what mine is, which means it's a lot more simplified than like a normal car engine. There's no mechanical linkage or anything like that. It just generates electricity.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's very good. And, so you mentioned the number plate. Mm-hmm. So I came up with this idea. So as I've revealed to podcast listeners before, my Tesla has this number plate by BYE, as in goodbye, CO2, carbon dioxide. So I came up with this idea that maybe I should try and get the number plate by CO1. So we'd have by CO1 and by CO2. I thought, well, probably very few people on the road would actually get the joke if they saw it, unless we were traveling in convoy.
Yeah. Oh, unless you could get something else, like, I don't know, by SO2 for sulfur dioxide. I think that's a byproduct of burning fossil fuels as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of byproducts, but none of them are quite as significant as CO2. I don't think we're producing any methane out of petrol cars, but maybe we are. I appear to be put right on that.
All right, so I think this is one for our listeners. Please write into us and let us know how Craig can outdo the cheesiness of his existing number plate with something that's even more awful, please.
Yes, well, I might just leave the existing number plate on it, which is 3 alphabetic characters and 3 digits.
Oh, boring, but cheaper as well than spending, what, $600 plus on a personalized plate?
I think it's about $1,000 for a personalized plate.
I thought they still start at $600, but if you want one that's a bit more interesting,
maybe
the price goes up.
Yeah, I think if you want a special color one or something. Yeah.
But even just, I think they
figure to do with the number of characters.
Popular ones are, and they charge more when they realize that they can do.
Yeah. I worked with a guy back in the 90s who reckoned that doing a search for the number plate you wanted online was a bad thing because then the personalized plates people were recording that was popular and they would put the price up.
Maybe. I like that conspiracy theory.
I am at the personalized plates site now.
It's kind of like what you're saying, Mark, about, you know, that's that rumor about flights. You know, if you keep on looking for a certain flight, the airline companies, their websites will pick up that you're looking for a flight on a certain date, and they'll artificially up the price.
Yeah.
And therefore, okay, whenever you're searching for flights, you should, you know, either go incognito or clear your history.
Yeah,
is that true?
Well, wow.
Should we be skeptical about that claim and just accept that airlines want to gouge us?
Well, didn't Mark's old boss come on and sort of poo-poo that idea a bit?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent. Yeah, I think that doesn't really happen, but I don't know. I should test it. Next time I go internationally, fly somewhere, I will test whether this happens or not. So for anybody that's interested in a personalized plate, this is one I looked at a while ago and went, no, I can't do it. I just can't. But SKPTC is available for Skeptic.
If you have to explain it, it's not a good plate.
But I think with the E or with the I are both already gone from memory. So you just have to get rid of all vowels.
It's probably taken by a climate change skeptic.
Yeah, driving around a big pickup truck just to undo all the good work you're doing for the environment.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, but to finalize the story, I have now been driving to work this week. It's only the second day, and it is the school holidays, but I'm getting to work, including the walk, in about 3/4 of an hour. So similar time to what the bus was taking me into the city, but at least I'm getting a 15-minute walk into the bargain. And getting home at night is taking me about 3/4 of an hour. So that's including that 10-minute walk home, so to the car from work. So I'm quite pleased about that, and I'm getting 20-25 minutes back in my day at the end of the day. So
see, I had the same thing as you. So a few years ago I got a new job, and previously I'd been working from home, and this job was in an office, and I started commuting and I didn't like it, and so I gave it up after a year, not 2 weeks. It took me a year before it was like, actually, I'm just going to pay for a parking space and drive in every day. So I think I've got a little bit more sticking power than you have here.
I'm not quitting my job.
Admittedly, there was a pandemic in the middle of it and nobody went to work for a while. So I got a little bit of a reprieve in the middle.
Right. Right.
So, Craig, you had a bit of a reality check when it came to using public transport. What other things have happened in New Zealand that constituted a reality check?
Who put you in charge of the segways?
Myself. I can pull something out of my ass every now and then.
Yeah. Wow. And that was actually not a bad one either. I think I have to applaud you, at least thank mentally. You. Actually, no, hang on. There we go. Actual applause for the segue. Good work.
Very good. Yes, well, last Tuesday, we all got some good news, or terrible news, depending upon your perspective. And that was that the Reality Check Radio, the online radio station run by the Voices for Freedom people, was off the air. And so they were no longer broadcasting. And I'm sure there are a whole bunch of conspiracy theorists who were quite sad at this fact. But the Reality Check Radio people came out with a quite a long and quite a slickly produced video announcing the fact that they'd gone off air, and how terrible it was, and what life would be like without Reality Check Radio. And this was all narrated mostly by Peter Williams, who, for those Kiwis who don't know, used to be a presenter on TVNZ for a number of years. He was quite well respected, I think. And then he retired from TVNZ and went and worked at Magic Talk Radio, which was a talkback program. And then he started going down the rabbit hole, and he had, I think it was during the peak of the pandemic that he had started interviewing people on his Magic Talk program about various things, about the dangers of the vaccine and all that sort of stuff, all conspiracy theory-related topics. And at one point, well, not one point, he ended his association with Magic Talk quite swiftly. It would seem, when I remember it at the time, it appeared that he got booted off the air for his wacky, crazy opinions. So he came with just asking questions. Where have we heard that before? So he has become the darling of Voices of Freedom and been one of the main hosts on Reality Check Radio. And he was the guy who was fronting this video saying what it was going to be like if we didn't have Reality Check Radio, if there wasn't anybody to hold the government to account, to ask the hard questions. Well, I say that we wouldn't have anybody who was interviewing conspiracy theorists and some very, very weird, wacky beliefs about how the world works and how things are happening for a reason and so on. So in addition to him appearing on that video, there were some interviews with some listeners to Reality Check Radio saying how much Reality Check Radio had meant to them. And anyway, the reason that Reality Check Radio is off the air is because they've run out of money. So that's generally an ending thing for many organisations. The economic reality is that they actually need money to function. So they've got a bunch of hosts, and I imagine they're paying them at least some money to be on the air because they're regularly on the air. And then they've got all their streaming costs and presumably equipment costs. They claim to have studios, but I don't know. I think at least some of their studios are people's home offices. But the reason they seem to have studios is because, as part of this pitch, in order to get back on the air and asking people for money, they have said, okay, well, if you're rich, you can join the Reality Radio VIP Supporters Club. And if you happen to have $1,000, you can join their club. And there are various different levels, starting at $1,000 and going up to $100,000. And depending upon the amount of money you give them, you get these various privileges. And one of the privileges at the higher levels is you get a tour of the studio. So that to me says that they actually do have studios. Oh, and incidentally, at the $100,000 level, if you give them that much, they promised a firstborn child. They didn't say whose firstborn child, but I think they were joking.
I mean, Chantal Baker definitely has a child, so it could be hers.
Wow, this is true. This is true, yes. Quite a recently firstborn.
Maybe she's already realized that motherhood isn't for her and she's trying to give it away.
Ooh.
Yes. But anyway, so in their promotional stuff that comes through email, they've revealed that the subscriptions that they've had, so last year they set up a subscription scheme where their listeners, their loyal listeners, could say, I want to become a subscriber to Reality Check Radio and pay a monthly amount to fund the service. And so what they've revealed is that they're only getting about 35% of their required revenue in order to run from their regular monthly subscribers. So if you do the maths on that, in order for them to get up to 100%, they actually have to triple their subscriptions coming in, or get some people who are going to put their hands in their pockets and put some big donations in to the pot. Mm. So I'm predicting that they won't be coming back on air, at least not in their current form. I just don't see how they're going to get that sort of level of donation. I think there's always an initial surge of enthusiasm for these things. People will pay more money up front, and they will then drop off unless they can somehow keep listeners interested and keep them donating money. And of course, we are supposedly in tough economic times, and a lot of people are feeling the pinch, and so a subscription to Reality Check Radio might be one of those things that goes by the wayside, particularly when you can still listen to Reality Check Radio for free on the internet. I guess there were a few benefits that came along with the subscription, including 30% off merchandise.
Well, not everyone can be
seen
as,
dead.
I mean, not everyone can be as lucky as Sean Plunkett and scoring a massive, you know, permanent sponsorship by the Wright Foundation.
Well,
or the Wright family,
yes.
At least.
Well, is it permanent? Anyway, yes. Here's the other internet media outlet that does have a few wacky beliefs, but I don't think they're quite as bad as Reality Check Radio. But yeah, so he actually came out and he was actually a bit skeptical that Reality Check Radio were dead. He thought it might all just be a publicity stunt. Of course, if it is just a publicity stunt, then they're going to piss off a lot of their listeners, I think.
Yeah, no, because I think what will happen is when they come back on air, they will do this big thing about thanks to the amazing support from all you listeners. Look, we managed to come back. You saved us. And if you read just the frequently asked questions on their off-air page, which is the page you get redirected to when you visit the site, it does say we are confident Reality Check Radio will be able to return to the air at some point in a format and duration proportional to the level of financial support received. So I think they're probably not fully run out of money. I think what's happening, as you said, is they've probably not got enough money to keep doing what they're doing. So they're going to have this big push to make whatever money they can, get any new subscriptions, and then they're probably going to have to downgrade in some way what they're doing, you know, move into mum's basement and record it there or something like that.
But
they are committed to keeping it going. It is something, you know, that they say they're coming back. It's just, is it going to be reduced content, reduced number of hours per day, maybe,
cutting down on their advertising? I mean, because they're still going with Jolly Billboards, unless we do know that Jolly Billboards is sort of sympathetic to the Reality Check Radio. But that's not cheap.
Yeah, so that's them not carrying advertising, but them advertising Reality Check Radio to people. Yeah,
they also have some really nice non video billboards as well. So yeah, could be one way to cut it down, but they seem to be keeping a lot of the branding. So it's interesting that there's some money going around still to make it all look cohesive, including their "we're off the air." That still looks cohesive as well.
So you mentioned the Wright Family Foundation. I actually sort of thought that was interesting because Sean Plunkett's outfit is funded by WFF and RCR is funded by VFF. There's a connection there.
Conspiracy, I love it.
Am I making too many connections? But anyway, I mean, who knows? I guess they probably will be back in some form. Maybe they'll have fewer interviews and actual live content and more replays, which will obviously be cheaper to do. But of course, they will have some overheads that are fixed, unless they go and move, as you say, into mum's basement. Who knows?
Maybe they need to move on to Zoom, like we do, run out of budget on a sweat, smell, and oily rag.
But I guess we'll just have to watch the space and see whether they come back.
Jeez, Craig.
But even if they did come back, would we be able to archive their content?
Well, that's a good question there, Craig. And it's actually a legitimate one. How do we feel about, you know, keeping something like, you know, all the radio shows that Reality Check Radio have produced? You know, what is the value that would have for future New Zealanders? Would it be a capsule into, you know, this very specific time in New Zealand history? And who would take on the role of that? And that's something I wrote about, you know, sort of exploring a little bit in this week's newsletter article. What kicked it all off for me is that kind of actually got a couple of emails on this topic. One was regarding Ohad Pelly. If you've been following both the newsletter and this podcast, I've mentioned Ohad Pelly before. He is one of sort of the leaders of the International School of the Temple Arts. He's an associate of Bruce Lyon, who runs Haydn Temple. And Haydn Temple and sort of the International School of Temple Arts have been sort of a focus of this, you know, a lot of issues that have come up with the Neo-Tantra movement, as well as have been sort of the subject of Morgan Penn's first season of her podcast, Sex.Life. So the idea of Ohad Pelly, who is an Israeli an ex-rabbi from Israel, he sort of popped up in a lot of news pieces, not written by not written by me, but by other people about his behavior, quite a lot of it questionable, allegedly criminal behavior in the conscious sexuality movement in Israel and overseas. The concern was from somebody in the Culty Conversations Facebook group was that, hey, Ohad has been able to get his website de-archived by the Wayback Machine, which is run by the Internet Archive or archive.org. And that's actually kind of problematic because as someone who does a lot of research into cults and into sort of, particularly from New Zealand perspective in terms of cults and charismatic fallen gurus who've worked in New Zealand, being able to access a lot of this sort of ephemera, the digital ephemera and old websites of these groups is really important because it allows you to sort of track how these groups have evolved and how they used to represent themselves and a lot of that evolution into becoming these very problematic organizations that they became. So this is really particularly important in terms of the work that I've done with Haydn and Bruce Lyon. A lot of his stuff from the early 2000s is archived on the Internet Archive. And that's been really valuable in terms of finding out this massive web of how people are interconnected. So why is it an issue with this Israeli ex-rabbi? Well, this rabbi was very much involved with Adi Dam, which is a different organization run by a different problematic leader. Why, you know, how you get your website de-archived is an interesting process, as well as the different reasons as to why. Because I think a lot of us didn't really expect that. You know, we kind of anticipate that anything that's on the Internet Archive, well, it's there. Why would anyone take it off? But there are reasons why people would want websites removed. So one of them is looking at, for some people who've been online, like who've had blogs or something for like 10, 20 years, they've had it since when they were children. They're a little bit embarrassed by the cringe and they want that taken away. From a more corporate point of view, if you bought your domain from somebody or you're selling your domain to another or your domain got sold to another organization, and maybe you don't agree with what that organization is going to do or has done, you don't want your work associated with that new domain. So you can go back to the Internet Archive and say, hey, look, here's my prove that you owned it and get your information or your private information removed from the archive. So there's interesting reasons why. But coming as from a skeptical point of view and thinking about the work that people like Susan Gerbic does with the Guerrilla Skeptics of Wikipedia, having websites like, you know, that are run by gurus, run by cults, run by high control organizations, to have them removed is such a loss, not only to like sort of my particular interest in the history of these organizations, but actually in terms of the evidence that we have that these people and organizations have behaved poorly and have caused harm.
I guess from what I've used of the Internet Archive in the past, in looking up sort of previous versions of people's websites, I think it's relied upon the fact that most of these people who have these dodgy websites are technically pretty incompetent and so are even unaware of the Internet Archive that it exists and that people can take a snapshot of their website at a particular point in time and see what it looked like and say, okay, well, you've made these changes. It's evolved over time. This is highly interesting, isn't it?
But I think also some people are highly egotistic and, you know, to be able to have that record of what their website looked like, you know, there is a advantage. There is a strategy to having a website on Internet Archive that a lot of people recognize, which is in terms of A, being able to prove that you have ownership of a domain in case something gets stolen or you're a victim of fraud. And some people also say, hey, look, there's a really interesting aesthetic interest into how a website evolves. And some people are just simply egotistical.
Yeah, so I think, I guess, there's a couple of lessons here for skeptics. The first one is the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine part of it, which does the archiving of these web pages, is a really good tool, and you can use it. It's not something where the people that run it decide which sites are archived. If you go on there and you search for a domain name that's not archived, I think it immediately starts archiving itself. It adds it to the list of things that should be archived, and then it starts scraping the site from then on. But this second lesson, an equally important one, is that you can't trust that whatever you get archived on there or someone else has already archived is going to be there forever. There is a real risk, especially if it's something controversial, that the people that run this website may ask for it to be taken down. I guess legally they're allowed to. I think like a lot of stuff on the archive.org, there's a lot of like old content like ZX64 computer games and abandonware music and things like this. I think a lot of it gets shoved up there by default with the understanding that if the copyright holder ever comes forward, the archive will just remove it immediately. It's like, oh yeah, it belongs to you, I'll just get rid of it. So it's the same with websites, I guess. When you say, no, that's my copyrighted material, you are within your rights to ask them to remove it.
And this is the same thing with physical archives as well. I mean, the role of an archivist or a librarian is actually to sort of parse out what stuff is actually going to be important to keep. and what stuff isn't important to keep. And the same thing actually adheres, is relevant to the idea of digitally, of not just digital preservation, which is about the preservation of physical objects digitally, it's about the preservation of digital objects, our websites, our music, even GIFs. And we see this a little bit in sort of the current issue that they're now having in terms of the risk of millions of science, like millions of academic articles, which are at risk of disappearing. There was an article printed in Nature in March of this year, which looked at, you know, how many academic articles are not properly archived, despite having a DOI number. Now, a DOI number is meant to be sort of that permanent identifier, permanent number that you could link to, and that you're, that's where this article would be archived. But because of open access journals, some articles, in terms of this whole publication race, some articles are only published on maybe one, maybe two archives. And the article in Nature estimated probably about 170 open access journals have shut down in probably, I think, the past decade or so. And that actually has a massive impact on the availability of articles. So what does it mean if you're trying to find out what someone's source is? You know, and this could be really good scientific, it could be really good humanities research. And, you know, these articles disappear because they're not being properly archived. For these open access journals, the issue is still is, even though these are all digital objects, how do you store? How do you pay for the servers? Who is going to be, keep, you know, making sure that you don't have links that are broken, making sure that the files are still available, still, you know, and they're not, you know, there's no viruses, et cetera. You know, that's all stuff that takes time, money, and skill. And so, again, it goes back to even in a digital, even though something like, you know, what is a gig doesn't really have a, you know, doesn't have a dimension, but it does actually have space in the form of a server space.
I guess for skeptics, screenshots are very useful, personal screenshots.
But
yeah, you know, I could think of stuff I've written where I've written a document about EM Power Plus True Hope. There's a company that sells vitamin pills as a cure for lots of mental health issues, and it's nonsense. And there was a really good website online where someone basically tore them down, had a lot of stuff about the history of the organization, their Mormon roots, a lot of the unscientific nonsense, the bad business practices. And this document I wrote relied heavily on links to that. If you want to learn more, just go and read here. And then suddenly the site went down, presumably because of legal pressure, and that whole resource disappeared. And, you know, I was kicking myself that I really should have taken a local copy, and disappointing that I didn't.
Well, I mean, when I was doing my work on the Jeff Botkin last year, in terms of that whole series about evangelicals either coming to New Zealand or coming from New Zealand, there was a really massive resource which included his stuff, his work with the Great Commission, as well as a lot of the work that Jeff Botkin was doing, did in New Zealand with the CTV building. And that link is kind of gone, but someone had archived it on, guess what? The Wayback Machine. So I was still able to use that. But just doing a screenshot is just sort of an image on one page. The beauty of the Wayback Machine is that it kind of takes not just the page that you're looking at, it kind of pulls it, as Mark says, it scrapes, so it gets all the links that are associated with that page, you know. So it's looking at the context, it'll pull in the context, it'll pull in whatever side links, and sometimes there's some really interesting stuff in those side links, you know. Again, I sort, as Mark will point out, I kind of drag in, I'm looking at property records, so for me sometimes I actually do want to know where they're saying their businesses at one point or another, because that also helps me confirm other things in terms of what businesses people have run and what ran out of a building.
So one thing I would recommend for people who are at least slightly technically able is that on Linux, or these days on Windows, if you run the Windows subsystem for Linux, which will allow you to have a Linux command line.
Was that version 1 or version 2, Mark?
Version 2, please. Version 1, it was nice at the time, but it was definitely old and clunky, and version 2 is a lot nicer. So you can run a command called wget, and if you look online and just look for instructions on how to do this, you can basically give wget a domain name and tell it to scrape all pages, but not to follow links that go outside of that domain to external domains. And it can do rewriting of URLs and not re-downloading the same file twice and some smarts like this. And it will basically drop into a folder an entire copy of at least the publicly accessible and linked to pages on that site. And then you can just, I guess, zip that up and keep a copy of that somewhere safe. And then you know you've definitely got it. Probably upload it to a cloud service as well, I'd imagine. But yeah, if you're doing something where you really need a copy and you know you can't rely on archive.org, there are ways of scraping it locally that are pretty easy.
So I wonder what the legal ramifications of that would be were you to, say, write an article in the New Zealand Skeptical Journal or newsletter or whatever it's called these days and actually reference something, and then that site owner comes along and says, oh, I don't like what you've written about me, and you had no right to take a copy of my website. Take it down.
I think we probably do. I'm not sure whether we have a right to make it public, but I think privately owning a copy is probably on firmer ground legally, I think, because, you know, they've made it available publicly.
Yeah, yeah. I guess publishing it on the internet means it's in the public domain.
I mean, there are countries that have right to be forgotten laws. So, you know,
we should prefix this all with, I am not a lawyer, but.
Yeah, I am not a lawyer. No, that's correct. But there are.
I'm also not a lawyer, just to put that down.
Yeah. But there are countries that have right to be forgotten laws. And these are important laws to have when you think about, you know, revenge porn, like people who are having their, you know, their images being distributed in a malicious manner, not by themselves, but by an ex or someone random. And yes, individuals do, you know, we do need to consider the individual right to, you know, no longer be stigmatized or, you know, have their images or their personal details available freely on the web in terms of, you know, the sort of malicious action. And I guess we can think about, you know, something like other groups that have been in New Zealand, like Centrepoint. Imagine if you really weren't, you know, you lived in Centrepoint for a bit, particularly if you were a Centrepoint teenager, and then you leave, and then someone's put up all these Centrepoint articles or Centrepoint magazines available digitally.
Yeah,
if that happened, I would not publish any pictures of any of the children, but, you know, if these things were up and available for people to access digitally, you know, yes, those children and probably people, ex-members, would have a right to say, hey, look, I don't want my images there. But what is the public, what would be the benefit to the public of having access to those journals to actually see, hey, look, here's actually what was going on? Full disclosure. How do we negotiate that conflict?
Mm. Yeah, well, it's the balancing of privacy rights with the public's right to know, I guess.
Mm. Or is there a way that, you know, that you, you know, like they did in the Centrepoint documentary, every time there's a child or a minor, they just blurred out the faces.
Yeah, right.
So I think the end of your article was an interesting question, Bronwyn, about, you know, is there a space for someone to build a more robust service? And I think like archive.org's Wayback Machine is great for the archiving. It's not perfect.
No.
And it's really slow. It's horribly slow at times, which I can understand. You know, this will probably be terabytes and terabytes of data that they've stored. And
it's at risk. It's also at risk itself. There was a recent legal battle, I think in February, regarding not so much Wayback Machine, but archive.org. Because it was sort of ruled that they were in violation of publishers' rights because they also have lots and lots of books available for people to access.
So the books they've always run as a library service where one person can check them out at a time, which has always been fine. Mm. But at the beginning of COVID, archive.org said, actually, we've got billions of people stuck at home. We're going to scrap the only one person can read at a time thing and just open it for everybody to read because everybody's going to be bored at home. And this is what the publishers have come at them for, is the fact that they basically kind of scrapped the legal norms of trying to restrict how many people could read the book. And I think they tried to keep doing that for as long as possible. And the publishers just weren't happy because as far as they were concerned, it was losing profit. So yeah, that was definitely an interesting case. Mm. Building a service, I think that's something that, like, it can be done better technically, but legally, I can't help but think that the legal costs involved with keeping up websites when people are coming at you with lawyers is not going to be cheap. Maybe if you go and host it on Sealand or some other weird data center on some oil rig in the middle of nowhere, maybe you'd have more chance.
Or potentially we could go to, was it Norway or Iceland? One of those countries that has the Seed Vault also has a code vault. An underground code vault.
Oh, okay.
So do we need an underground internet vault? Just so that, you know, when humanity falls in 2025 or 2038 or whenever, we can just, you know, access our old versions of Amazon for a little point and giggle.
Because that'll be the prime concern of people who have existed after the world has been destroyed, that they'll want to go and have a look at what skeptics recorded about websites that existed in the past.
I want us to have a secret skeptics lair under a volcano somewhere, if possible. I think that would be awesome.
I probably think the most practical thing we can do is start, you know, potentially advocating in some way to our national library, which does do the digitization and sort of digital preservation in New Zealand, to really actually consider our cults and our gurus as a potential subject of interest and priority. I know a lot of people think, oh, you know, no, we don't want to hold these documents. We don't want to make these their work available because, you know, that's just perpetuating and giving them more airtime, giving them, you know, letting their work sort of exist in perpetuity. But I guess, again, from a researcher point of view, it's actually, you know, we often, this stuff gets forgotten a lot of the time, and it makes us prone to make the same mistakes over and over again. You know, why are we letting the same people, why are we letting the same organizations, you know, the same manipulative types of groups sort of start always rebuild in New Zealand in a new way, because we're constantly forgetting what's happened in the past.
Okay. So, Mark, can audio predict earthquakes? Songs predict earthquakes?
Was that a segue? Because if it was, it was so subtle I didn't pick up on it.
Yes, it was a segue. May not have been a very good one, but...
I still much prefer Bronwyn's. Hers was great. Yeah.
Okay. Bronwyn, have you got one to introduce that topic? I can edit out my one if you've got a better one.
Oh, man. I wasn't even thinking. I was going to hang the... You know, I took a roll off of you, and I was hoping that you'd have enough time to think of a segue yourself.
Yeah, he went quiet for a while, and he still didn't pull out anything good. I was very disappointed in that one. All right. So, yes. So, song lyrics and time traveling. So, this was an email we got recently at the New Zealand Skeptics, trying to get us to watch a video. And the email said, I have found something some may call paranormal, though I do believe it can be explained scientifically. A song from 1995, Tosh, brackets, Shriek Back Wash, contains dialogue including the words 7.6, Noto, and New Year 24. Which is especially odd because there was indeed a 7.6 earthquake on the Noto Peninsula on New Year's. We then had a link to the YouTube video, and this person finishes with, in the above link, I have transcribed most of the words. I hope you will find this phenomenon to be thought-provoking. Most interested to read any feedback from you. So as a committee, we had a quick look at it. And then on the weekend, I dove into this some more. And you know, this kind of thing's interesting. If I can use some of my technical knowledge to do something, it's like, oh, this is good. I'm putting my technical know-how to good skeptical use. And I looked at this thing. The video itself was kind of interesting. One thing I noticed was in the YouTube description, something that was written in brackets that he'd written there was, I was actively trying to send this information, which from what I can tell suggests that this guy thinks that he sent information about the earthquake back in time to the song and somehow had it embedded in the song. Now, looking into this, I first went and grabbed a copy of the lyrics. Just to see, can I see, you know, if I look on lyrics.com or something like that, what are we looking at as far as the lyrics are concerned? But the song's lyrics is basically all about super something else. Every line has the word super in. And this song it's by an artist called Fluke. I actually have a few of Fluke's albums from back in the 90s. So I bought up what I had. And I figured let's see what versions I've got and let's see how good a quality audio I've got of this. It turns out that the three versions of this song that I had, none of them have this audio clip. So the version that this guy has used is a very specific remix. So in the UK back in the 90s, people would release normally two CD singles. Whenever they were doing a new piece of music release, they were releasing a single from an album, they'd release two different CDs. And often for electronic artists, one CD might have other songs that maybe didn't make the album, but the other one might be remixes. And often those remixes would be getting other artists to remix the original track. And this is one of the tracks that was a remix done by an almost unheard of band. I mean, I'm from the UK, and I was around when Shriek Back were a thing in the UK. They were never a big enough thing that I've ever heard of them in my life. But this 80s London band, Shriek Back, did a remix of this kind of ambient electronic music, this track. And it's in this remix, which I think jumps from about 5 minutes to maybe seven or more minutes, that in the intro to it, in the first couple of minutes, they've put an audio recording that's separate to the song lyrics. And that audio recording where two of these three supposed traveling back in time sets of words have been injected into. And listening to it, I figured out that it sounded like a phone call. You know how phone calls, especially traditional phone calls, they sound quite compressed. They sound flat, like there isn't a lot of dynamic range. So basically, I figured this is a phone call. Let's see what we can do to try and exclude, because I couldn't hear the words properly. Let's see what I can do to try and exclude as much of the audio that isn't the speaking as I can, all the musical stuff, and hopefully I can just be left with a nice clear piece of audio that I can hear and I can figure out what's being said. So the first thing I tried with this, so I found the first couple of minutes, which I loaded into Audacity, I zoomed in on just that and cut out the rest. And then I was able to amplify it because it was a little bit quiet compared to the rest of the track. I uploaded it to a couple of different AI tools, one of which one of our committee members, Dan Ryan, had suggested. Neither of those did a good job of pulling the audio out. It's used to proper song lyrics, proper singing vocals on top of a song. It's not used to this kind of compressed, almost garbled audio. So it really didn't work. So then I looked up, well, how was this compression done in phone calls? And it turns out that, but as standard, a phone call would limit the frequencies that are being used to be between 300 hertz and about 3 kilohertz. So 3000 hertz. So it's either 3 kilohertz or 3.4 kilohertz. There seem to be a couple of different standards for this, what's called narrow band, which is like the old traditional way of compressing a phone call. If you compare that 300 hertz to 3 kilohertz to a human voice goes from about 50 hertz to about 8 kilohertz. And what I didn't know that I found very interesting about this was that depending on male, female, etc., a human voice only has a natural frequency, a normal frequency of
100 hertz to 250.
And everything else is harmonics. So all those harmonics filling in those extra frequencies, and that gives us the deep, rich voices that we have. Figuring that this phone call was going to be probably 300 hertz to 3 kilohertz, even though the AI had failed, the old trustworthy open source Audacity, I went back to that, and it does have a vocal reduction and isolation plugin. So it comes as part of the package under the effects. And inside there, you can tell it, here is the low frequency that I want anything less than that for you to cut out. Here is the high frequency that I want you to cut out anything above that. And it has a strength to it. And so I spent quite a while fiddling with this. It's like, you know, first 300 to 3 kilohertz, strength of one. Crank up the strength, see what happens. And the more the strength went up, the more the whole thing went quiet. But I could reamplify, so that was kind of okay. But I'm losing fidelity every time I'm faffing with this thing. Then I was like, well, maybe
Mac,
I'll...
Yep. I don't know why you just didn't download the CSI tools for Audacity.
Is there an enhanced audio as well as an enhanced video? I really should have had that.
I reckon there must be.
So, yeah, so having done that, I tried different, like maybe if it's just 300 to 500. And I found that actually a lot of the subsets of the frequency range for a phone call, if I just chose, let's say 300 hertz to 1.5 kilohertz or 1.5 kilohertz to 3 kilohertz, any subset, it really didn't sound like a human voice at all. I kind of lost a lot almost immediately. It was very hard to find any part of that frequency range that, and I guess this is why they use this frequency range, because I'm guessing it was the minimum where you could still easily understand a human voice and still get away with a ton of compression. So I'm guessing that's why I couldn't get away with anything more than that. So I did this, and I did the best that I could, which was, I think, about in the end, about a strength of 5, frequency from 300 hertz to 3 kilohertz, reamplified it afterwards. And then I sat there in my living room and I listened as hard as I could to figure out, because I'm interested in, has this guy actually got it right? He says it says 7.6 Noto in New Year 24. Let's just check first. independently that he is actually reading this or hearing this properly. Has he got this right? And no matter how much I listened, I could not make head nor tail of any of it, which was interesting because I know when I'd watched his original that he seemed to have figured out quite a bit of it. Like watching the subtitles that he'd added to the video that he shared with us and looking at how they matched the audio that I was listening to, he seemed to have done pretty good. I was getting none of that. When I tried it independently, it was like I'd gone backwards from where this guy had gone. I was doing really badly. And then I had this sudden realization, this revelation, which is basically that maybe he was just as bad at it as I was. Maybe he couldn't hear a damn thing either, because I think he just listened to the original track, whereas I'd done a bunch of filtering to make it easier to hear, and I still couldn't do this. And it was like, maybe this is just a hark back to my article on backmasking in rock and roll songs in America in the 80s. Maybe when I listen to this music while watching his subtitles, it's suggesting to me that this is what I'm going to be hearing. And when I'm told in advance, these are the words you're going to hear, then I can hear them clearly. But without that prompting, without being told, this is what you're going to hear, it's just a garbled mess. And I suddenly realized that actually this guy probably couldn't figure out what it was, but he injected what he wanted to be in there. You know, he already had this idea, most likely, that this was the event that he wanted to find in a song. He probably went out and listened to hundreds of songs until he found one that was just right. And it's an obscure mix of an obscure song. You know, it really didn't make the top of the charts or anything. And this was a CD that maybe a few thousand people bought in the UK, and that's it. But he managed to listen to so much music, I think, that eventually he found one that had the earthquake that he was interested in proving had been traveling through time to his ears. He convinced himself of this. And damn it, he nearly convinced me as well for a second, except when I did listen to it, I was like, I'm not sure that it's saying this. And then I realized that actually all of it. So I typed out everything that he had written down that he thought he was hearing in this. And it made no sense. If this really was a phone call, the guy was just talking nonsense from the beginning to end. And a lot of it I could clearly enough hear that even though I couldn't work out quite what was being said, it definitely didn't match the text that this guy was giving. So it was all over the place. Like this guy had just, he wanted to be a time traveler. And if he can't actually travel in time, he wanted to make this prediction of an earthquake travel in time. And I think he must have worked his ass off until he managed to find a piece of music that was good enough that he figured he must have projected his thoughts back in time to the lead singer of Shriek Back or whoever did this remix. And then voila, 25 years later, he was there to find the thing that he projected. And yeah, I realized I'd basically been sent on a fool's errand. As far as I could tell, this guy made up all of this text and I was just wasting my time looking into it. But I guess I did enjoy the journey. I did enjoy trying to technically pull this track apart and see what was going on. I just realized that even if I was able to hear the phone call clearly enough that I could figure out the words, it's still not going to make a difference. It's still not going to do anything that I couldn't already do, which is basically say, this guy didn't do it. This guy just made up words. And so why should I bother spending any more time on it? And that was my audio journey.
Mm. Yes. Well, some interesting stuff in there. You were talking about compression.
Mm.
Made me think about how compression would work in telephone systems, and actually early telephone systems used carbon granule microphones as the microphone picking up your voice, and I believe that would produce quite a compressed signal because the sound was just sort of compressing carbon granules to change the voltage, and they would typically not have a very big dynamic range, and so
it was just a limitation of the technology rather than a need to limit bandwidth.
I think so. But the bandwidth itself, I believe it was done, so you're saying 300 hertz to 3.4 kilohertz. I think that was done so that they could actually have multiple signals on the same copper wires.
Because you could just frequency shift, right?
Yeah, frequency shift up. So you could actually have the same pair of copper wires carrying multiple telephone conversations.
Yeah.
Yes, all very interesting. So what you're talking about is priming.
the psychological yeah. effect of priming, and that you were expecting to hear a particular piece of text. It would be interesting if you sort of isolated that audio out to play it to somebody and say, what do you hear? And probably yeah. they're not going to say it's 7.6 Noto New Year's 24.
Well, even for me, it wasn't. When I'd given it a few hours, I hadn't looked at his video for a few hours and I was listening. I couldn't make head nor tails. And the point of revelation actually was the point at which I went, I can't figure out what's being said. Maybe I'll bring up the video in another window and read his text while listening to it just to help me. And at that point, I realized, as you say, that I'm just being primed. That's all the text is doing, is priming me to hear what he wants me to hear. And it's like, no, I shouldn't have to do that. I should be able to hear it independent of that. And if I can't, he wouldn't have been able to. And if he wouldn't have been able to, he's just made up words that he wants to think are in this track. I really enjoyed it.
Even proper song lyrics suffer from the Lady Mondegreen effect.
The what?
The Lady Mondegreen effect.
All right, geez. Come on.
You don't know about this?
Nope, but I'm about to know about it.
Well, let me just look it up so that I get it right. So a Mondegreen is a mishearing of lyrics, and the phrase...
Oh, laid him on the green.
Yes, laid him on the green.
Became Lady Mondegreen.
And Lady Mondegreen, yes. Yes, so yes. So there are lots of famous Lady Mondegreens. I would have to look some up. But, yeah, there's all these misheard lyrics of songs. And, I mean, there are many pop songs that I have had to look up the lyrics for because I have actually gotten them wrong in my head, thinking it. Certain words are being said when, in fact, it was something completely different. And off the top of my head, I can't think of anything right now, but I guess...
Yeah, I think everybody has this, ones, right? It's a very common thing.
One of the famous ones from the 80s, I think, was Courier Liaison. What's that song? Let me just check that.
You take your time. It's not like we've got listeners listening or anything.
Yes.
They can have a minute of silence while you search something on the internet.
Yeah, there's a Roman Catholic piece of text which translates into Lord have mercy. So Kyrie eleison, but that's actually a famous lyric from an 80s song, and people misinterpret it as carry a laser. I'm just trying to think what this name of the band was. Okay, I'm just doing a little bit more Googling. Oh, Mr. Mister.
I think you might be showing your age. I'm not sure I know what this is. Is it a Kiwi thing?
No, it was an American band. Yeah, I might have to mix a little bit of that track into the audio so that people can hear it when I edit the episode. Okay, so, I guess the lesson of it is don't trust your brain when it comes to hearing audio lyrics, particularly if they're being transmitted back in time to cause or forward in time to cause earthquakes.
Yeah, and don't trust other people's interpretation at all. Just do your own research.
Yeah. All right. So what's coming up on the Skeptical Calendar?
Quite a few things, starting with the Wellington Skeptics, this Friday, April 19th at 6 p.m. It's our bi-weekly Skeptics in the Pub at the Intercontinental Hotel. So the hotel is located on 2 Gray Street, but we are not at the 2 Gray Street restaurant. We are inside the hotel's lobby lounge.
Just don't give the address and it's fine. Just tell them it's the lobby lounge and don't mention 2 Gray Street.
Well, the lobby lounge isn't signposted as a lobby lounge. There's a lounge where you can.
I'm going to cut this bit out.
And there's a restaurant that you also order food.
Tell them go to the lounge in the lobby then, and not
you
go to the lobby.
You tell them to go to the lounge. You tell them to go to the lounge.
Everybody,
in the lobby.
Go to the lounge in the lobby. I won't see you there because I'm not going to be there this week, sadly. So in fact, don't even go this week. Honestly, it's going to be boring without me. Go in 2.5 weeks' time. That'll be much better.
You're going to hear lots of spoilers because Mark doesn't like it when we talk about shows that he hasn't watched.
Well, is there anything I've not watched? I think I'm up to date now. Keep having to stick my fingers in my ears because people had watched Dune Part 2 and I hadn't. But now I've seen it and it's all good. Everybody can talk about it.
And then when is the next science-based healthcare activism in the pub, Mark?
That will be next week on Thursday, which will be the 18 plus 7 is 25th. The 25th of April from 6 o'clock at the Fork and Brewer in Wellington.
You mean Anzac Day?
Well, it won't be on the 25th then. It'll be... Damn it. All right. So it'll be 2 weeks after that. And I can't count how many days are in the month. January, February, March, April, 30. So 25 plus 5. And then it's another 9. So the 9th of May? I think it'll be the 9th of May. We'll see you on the 9th of May. Check meetup.com. It'll be there.
All right.
Meetup.com/Wellington_skeptics_in_the_pub, maybe.
Something like that.
Surely there'll be hyphens, not something.
It is. It's actually Wellington-skeptics-in-the-pub.
Oh, it was dashes, not underscores. Damn it.
But similarly, on May 9th, but in Dunedin at Umbrello's Kitchen and Bar, is going to be the Dunedin Skeptics in the Pub. So they say that they're either booked in the PDR or the Crow's Nest. I don't know what either of those two things mean, but if you are in Dunedin, they know what it means. So ask them on their meetup page, which is Dunedin-skeptics-in-the-pub.
Like a foreign language.
But isn't Auckland different? Craig, what's the Auckland meetup URL?
Oh, Jesus, I don't know.
Come on, look it up.
How long was this podcast going on?
The funny thing about meetup is that the thing is, Wellington Skeptics in the Pub is the meetup I go to the most. It's pretty much my exclusive meetup. And it always puts that option like at the bottom. I have to go through pages in order to get our listing.
Right. If you want to go to Auckland Skeptics in the Pub, you go to https://meetup.com/Auckland-skeptics-in-the-pub.
Oh, hyphens, not dashes. It's good to know the difference. Hang on, aren't they the same thing?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it is the same URL style. All right.
We will be having our next meetup on the 7th of May, and we will be back at the Dice and Fork. Come and join us.
And also, it's time to say, hey, save the date. From November 15th to the 17th will be the joint New Zealand Skeptics and New Zealand Association of Rationalists and Humanists conference at the Fickling Convention Center in Auckland. So you can visit the conference.skeptics.nz website, which is going to be in the show notes, and just keep on visiting that website for details and updates as they become available.
Or listen to our podcast and we'll let you know.
Yeah. Mm. Or follow the Facebook page. I mean, you don't even really need to listen to the podcast.
You do. You absolutely need to listen to the podcast because we're amazing.
If people have got this far.
We are slowly by a whole act of attrition, making our way to the top of the New Zealand media pile.
As in, we're going to be the only ones left.
Well, Mark, you didn't talk about your little prank site.
No. Totally forgot about that. So on the back of their news, and they had this really daft list of things that they were helping to protect you from. What was it? Are you prepared to face the following challenges alone? Reality Check Radio said, if they go off air, censorship will control what you can say. Climate change policies will control your life. Digital IDs will control what you can do. Co-governance will stoke racial division. And so I very quickly put together our own version at podcast.skeptics.nz/off-air. And my version had a very nice list that basically matched this one. But I talked about how you were going to have problems like that Bigfoot will roam the countryside and homeopaths will replace our doctors and feng shui will rearrange our furniture. And the entire page looks almost identical to the Reality Check Radio one, just with a little bit of an advert for our podcast episodes and a little bit of a poking fun at Reality Check Radio.
Hmm. And what happens if they click through to the link?
Which one? The video?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to say. People are just going to have to find that out for themselves, aren't they? There's a good video on there. Definitely worth watching.
Slickly produced.
Just know that the ANR podcast is never going to give you up.
Oh, that's a bit of a hint. And yes, we when I announced that we were going off air, it was we were going off air until this episode came out. So we had a week's break. I lied on Facebook and said that we were going to be going to Fiji and drinking cocktails. Sadly, none of that happened. But with your support, if you will join the skeptics and give us lots of money, it will be enough to afford for the three of us to go to Fiji for a week. Please.
Maybe I'll cut that bit out, and I'll mix in some sounds of wind and coconuts falling on the on the beach. And
yeah, but can you be bothered?
No.
Yeah.
All right. You have been listening to the Year Now podcast. If you'd like to give us some feedback, please do to podcast@skeptics.nz. Otherwise, we will see you all at the various meetups and the conference, and see you next time. Goodbye.
Kakite.
Bye.